Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Bissett. I represent Marquita Moran Butler. She's here with me today, sitting in the back row. This is the third time I've been here on her case on issues involving average weekly wage. Maybe we didn't have arguments the first time, but in 2005, Judge Daley entered an opinion that allowed my client's average weekly wage to be increased to include the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance. The respondents appealed that to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court denied cert. It came back down, and there was a mandate to the panel and then to the administrative law judge to include the cost of continuing health insurance in the average weekly wage on remand. I thought I fairly well detailed this in my brief, and I'm assuming you've read it. The ALJ determined that he could reopen the issue of average weekly wage despite the final order from the Court of Appeals. We appealed that. We appealed it to ICAP. ICAP said, well, the two grounds for reopening, mistake and overpayment, he hasn't entered a final order. So he has to go back and resolve those issues and make specific findings about that. We appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said, it's not a final order yet. He needs to go back down, and the judge needs to comply with the directions from the Industrial Claims Appeals Office to enter a specific order. May I get a drink of water?
Certainly.
On remand, well, first the judge wanted us to file position statements, which we did in early January. Then he was unable to reconcile the different position statements that I tendered and Mr. Stirk tendered, so he asked for oral argument. So we had oral argument in May of 2010. He requested position statements again. And meanwhile, Mr. Stirk and I spent hours with a pre-hearing judge trying to work through these issues about what was owed, what had been paid, and what was still owing. So we had a stipulation that we'd reached as of a certain point in time and tendered that to the court. So we waited and waited and waited. On August 25th, the ALJ issued his order, and it was a summary order. It awarded benefits for specific time periods, but it was not specific as to the findings that the ICAP had required and that the Court of Appeals required on its remand in 2009.
Met with the ALJ in May of 2010. He indicated to you that he would be entering, or she, whoever it is, would be entering a summary order, correct?
That is correct.
So you had the expectation that a summary order was coming down
the pike,
right? He
also indicated that he expected both me and Mr. Stirk to help him with the final order.
He did say he would be entering a summary order.
He did say that.
And as an experienced lawyer, you knew that there was that statute out there that said if he does enter a summary order, you have 7 days within which to seek a final order, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And that's where the problem is.
Yes, I'm trying to move us along.
Right.
No, go ahead.
All right. Well, then let's talk about, I think the central issue here has to do with jurisdiction. And the jurisdictional issue, how do I put it? To me, I think they're on parallel paths. There's the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals to enforce its orders. There's an order that was entered in 2005, which the judge did not comply with. The specific directions were to include the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance. On remand, the respondent said, well, no, it should be a substitute amount. It should be Medicare. But that should have been raised in 2004 at the original hearing, and they didn't raise it.
Isn't part of the problem like, you know, chicken or the egg? In other words, you want to argue that, hey, in the order or orders, he didn't do what he was told to do. And isn't the question like, well, can we review those orders because the procedures set up by the statutes were not complied with? Is it your position that the statutory procedure for obtaining review is inapplicable when there's a remand order from this court?
That is my position.
Well, let me ask you this. I think we remanded back to the panel, to then back to the ALJ. It contemplates the ALJ making certain determinations. Those determinations don't come immediately back to us, do they? Don't they have to go up through the panel again before they come to us?
That's what happens.
then why wouldn't that statute or the statutory procedure apply?
Well, that's the conflict here. When the Court of Appeals remands with specific directions, the ALJ must comply with that. When it's a general remand, he can do other procedures to resolve it, but it still has to be consistent with the Court of Appeals order.
That's the content of the order. Can we review the order if the statutory procedure was not followed?
I think that's a question. That is the central question of jurisdiction in this case. My position is the Court of Appeals always has jurisdiction to enforce its orders regardless of those procedures. The reason I think the procedures don't apply is because there wasn't another evidentiary hearing. They're meant to apply when there's an evidentiary hearing. The ALJ is to enter either a summary order or a full order within 15 days. If he enters a summary order and somebody doesn't like it, they can ask for a full order. We've done that. We did that in 2004. We did that in 2007. And yes, on the 7 days, I was in trial. When the first day I got back from trial was the 8th day, and I called Mr. Stirk, I talked to him about it. He wasn't even aware of the order. He had not received the order. He had no objection to a one-day extension, but the judge said, no, the Walmart case is the one that controls here, and I don't have jurisdiction to even give you 1 day. So the next question I have for you on this issue of jurisdiction is, does an ALJ have discretion under
43-207-1I?
Yeah, and I didn't quote that correctly throughout my brief. I had it, it's just subparagraph one, other times subparagraph I, but that's the one. Does an ALJ have discretion on jurisdictional issues to extend the period of time? I think the statute that only gives 7 days to perfect an appeal is unreasonably short, and it borders on not allowing for due process. Previously, it was a 15 days. Then it was amended to 30 days. Now it's down to 7 business days. I think that anybody could get caught short in that, whether you're on vacation, you're sick, you're out for business reasons. I was in a 2-week trial. It's actually been decided by the Court of Appeals in Schuster versus Walter and Pinnacle.
It's not your position that the letter wasn't in your office. It was just that you didn't know it was in your office during those 7 days. Is that right?
It was in my office.
Okay. And you just weren't checking your mail while you were in trial?
I was in trial.
So even if we remanded this, you would have to make a showing, wouldn't you, under that statute that you just cited, that good cause excuse the failure to timely file, right? You would have to at least do that.
But, well, sure.
You had been to the Court of Appeals twice before this order was entered. There, no doubt, should have been no doubt in the administrative law judge's mind that it was coming back to the Court of Appeals because it had been remanded from the Court of Appeals. And yet he enters a summary judgment, which he knows, or a summary order, which he knows is not appealable.
Well, that's a problem, isn't it? Because he's determining his jurisdiction instead of the court.
Well, I'm just sort of amazed that an administrative law judge knows the case has been to the Court of Appeals. And the only reason it's before him now is for findings of fact and an order, final order, and yet he issues a summary order. Well, when he suggested earlier, or she suggested earlier, that that's what they were going to do, did you object to that?
What can I do to tell a judge, no, you can't issue a summary order? You know, if that's what he decides to do, I'm going to have to deal with it. I can't tell him what his what his job is. Did I object to it? Yes.
Lawyers like, wouldn't tell me what my job is. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to tell you your job today, you know, which is to find jurisdiction. And I think you can find it a couple of ways. One is the plenary power of the court to enforce orders that it is issued. And two, I think you can allow for a good cause extension of time. Because the absolute, you know, drop dead date is the 20-day petition to review, and we met that. We met that over and over and over again. So now you've got a conflict between the 7-day, two jurisdictional deadlines, 7 days and 20 days. We met the 20 days. All the cases most of these cases, with the exception of the Walmart case, where they say, well, the 15 days is a jurisdictional prerequisite, that's a new older version of the statute. Once you file a request for specific findings, it tolls the period for filing a petition to review. It doesn't toll the period anymore. That's no longer in the statute. So I got problems. You know, I got a problem with, you know, 7 days, 6 years worth of appeal is, you know, out the window. My client's benefits have been reduced by 50%. The ALJ has not resolved the findings of fact that he's supposed to enter. He has entered orders that don't comply with the law. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, and I wish I had more time.
I understand that part of the difficulty with this case, I think the court, whichever court, whether it be the trial court, district claims, the court of appeals, certainly this case has been long going, on standing, multiple issues. I think the issue that respondents have, and I apologize, William Stirk on behalf of the respondents, 19407, I should have made that at the beginning. But the problem the respondents have in this case is, yes, it's been fought. Yes, there's been remands. There's been multiple issues that have come up. But the bottom line with this is that the court made a remand. Judge Haar sought to fulfill the requirements of the remand. In fact, even during the court, during some of the issues, Judge Haar made the statement, I'm going to comply with the remand.
Isn't the problem the case got gummed up by the attempt to reopen it on some of these other issues?
It did early on, and that was one of the issues that the petitioner was fighting. We had it back in the 2005 era when we had this issue over the what do you include in an average weekly wage. There was some dispute in the courts, and originally the petitioner lost. However, the courts changed the opinion and said, wait a minute, as to this continued cost to healthcare, you don't have to go purchase it to get it in your average wage. So there was a reopening. The petitioner in this case, the claimant, was entitled to those benefits. At the time, there was, however, another decision that talked about COBRA benefits. And the issue was, can a respondent adjust an average weekly wage for the issue of COBRA benefits, because generally the COBRA benefits or the cost of living under Medicare, there's such a variation. There was a big fight under all of it. So unfortunately, in the comp system for a number of years, nobody really knew what to use as an average wage, and the courts, I think, now have pretty much solidified that. The issue that came up in the confusion, and unfortunately, I believe counsel is arguing, although I don't believe she can argue that at this point, is that she's trying to argue and say the courts were wrong back in 2005, 2007. We should have kept.
No, why can't she argue it? If it's a reviewable order, why can't she argue it? We precluded her from arguing those things back in 2007, I guess, when we said it's not a final judgment.
That's correct.
So why can't she argue these things if it's a final judgment, if it's reviewable by us at this point?
If it is reviewable, if it is a final judgment, I absolutely believe she can argue it. I probably misspoke. The issue is, had she properly filed the appeal, all of the issues in her brief, and I show at least she had five in the most recent brief, I think would be reviewable by this court. I have no problem with that. What the problem is when Judge Haar entered his order, he made specific findings. Counsel doesn't believe they went far enough to comply with the mandate. The respondents disagree. We believe it did go far enough.
I read the supplemental order. All it does is order the benefits. It makes no findings.
But within that order, it said from this date to this date, you will pay this amount. From this date to this
date. That's an order. There's no findings involved in that. The remand was for findings of fact and orders. That's what the remand was for, as I read it. I went to law school a long time ago. I thought when courts remanded cases and told people to do something, they did it. And the ICAO, it seems to me, clearly did not do what they were ordered to do. It was pretty simple.
Well, I believe the interpretation of that was to send down the findings, and the findings were to include how much benefits are for each period of time, which was absent in the prior order, which is part of the confusion, is we had so many wages up, wages down, offsets, that nobody really knew, okay, from what period of time do we pay what benefit? Judge Hart entered that order in a summary order, and in that order, he said, if there's confusion, if there's more needed, then request specific findings of fact. And that's what...
I thought the Court of Appeals ordered that. Why should the party have to request it?
I believe the party had to request it because if she disagreed with the way Judge Hart order entered, that was the issue in dispute. And if she believed that he did not comply at that time, that's what the appeal process is for. Respondents believed it was appropriate, it was sufficient to pay the benefits.
That was sufficient to appeal?
I believe it was because it gave the specific amounts and the periods of time that were due, and if additional information was needed, the ability to go back to the judge was there per the summary order, and they were certainly sufficient enough to file an admission of liability stating, okay, based on this order, here's all the money we owe, here's when we owed it, here's where there is or isn't overpayment. That complied with what the court wanted to do. If the petitioner believed that that wasn't sufficient or that wasn't a final order, that had to be covered under, I want a supplemental order within my 7 business days. Then if after that supplemental order, there wasn't enough to consider or to say, look, I don't believe they complied, then that would have been the remedy for what petitioner believes is wrong with the case.
But doesn't the good cause statutory provision apply to this 7-day business day, make a request for full order provision? Why doesn't it apply?
Well, because actually I believe there's a case on that discusses, I apologize, there was multiple cases.
Apply specifically to this request within 7 business day statute?
What the good cause, I believe this does address the point. This was in the case of Speer, S-P-E-I-E-R versus Industrial Claims Appeals Office, cited at 181 Pacific 3rd, 1173. I might have to borrow your glasses. And within that particular case under paragraph 5, it discussed good cause under 843-2071. And what the court discusses in there says 843-2071 small I provides ALJ discretion or discretionary authority to grant reasonable extensions of time for good cause shown. That discretion does not overcome the jurisdictional time limit set forth in the statute.
And was it this specific statute that was the subject of Speer? The 7 business day findings, prerequisite to ICAO review statute, is it that specific statute that was involved in Speer?
Yes, at this time it was again the 15-day.
Okay.
Predecessor statute.
I'm sorry.
The predecessor statute. A preceding version
of
the statute.
Yes, that's correct. Prior to the change from 15 days to 7. And in this particular case, it had to do with an attorney that had a case where medical benefits were denied to his client. And the order apparently came into his office but didn't get to him. And he said, wait a minute, this order, I didn't get the order and I should have the ability to apply and did not appeal within time. Now, within that particular decision, Judge Russell did dissent and was of the opinion that yes, there should be some type of good cause ability. The statute isn't that specific. It seems to allow for good cause, but the majority opinion at that time determined that no, that is not part of a determination when it relates specifically to jurisdictional issues. And I believe that is our belief that at that point, the way the case law is, at least at present, had there been that dispute, the remedy was appeal, that now the court does not have the ability, and the court's discussed does not have the ability to look at the merits of the underlying decision. And we believe that is why in this particular case, that the petitioner has lost that right and that the ALJ's order must be affirmed.
All due respect, sir, the statute that was at issue in Spire was 843.3012, the 20-day review period to the ICO, not the 7-day review of a summary order, if I read the case correctly.
And I apologize for that, Judge, but contained within that same statute, it discusses the fact that if you do not ask for a specific finding of fact or a full order, it's sometimes interchangeable in the language of the comp world, then you're not allowed to file the 20-day. It's a prerequisite, and since the statute says you shall do it, it is mandatory. Therefore, you still lose that right under that statute.
True.
And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
You don't get to.
I don't get to? Okay.
Are you done?
I believe this just one comment as to the issue of the attorney fees. In this regard, essentially the issue with that from the response is this case, from our perspective, is really an appeal of one order. And that one order, I guess actually two orders, but the primary order is whether Judge Hart did or did not properly preclude the petitioner from obtaining a full finding of fact.
And you think that's a frivolous issue to be raised on appeal?
That issue I do not believe is frivolous. In fact, I do believe the petitioner's first two issues out of her five, and specifically those two issues, were the right to appeal the August 25th, 2010 summary order, which certainly is Judge Hart's order, and then the court failure to for the failure of the underlying court essentially to comply to the Court of Appeals order, I believe those both certainly are not frivolous and colorable. The problem that I see with the rest of the argument is we're now arguing back to orders in 2005, orders that I believe have become final, or at least those issues are decided, and if petitioner won the issue that Judge Hart was wrong, then it would need to go back to Judge Hart for a full finding of fact and then go up the appeal process. Yet respondents in this case were essentially required to essentially defend everything as if she had not missed the appeal process. That is really, this should have been a very straightforward, maybe one, maybe two issues. It's been at least five and multiple derivations, excuse me. And that is why we believe that was certainly in this particular case not appropriate.
Sir, I have one more question. I'm sorry to belabor this, but the statute that we're specifically dealing with here is 843.215, subparagraph 1. Says if the judge makes a summary order within 7 working days of service, the party has to ask for, I guess it's called a full order, right? That's the statute we're dealing with here. Spire says there could be no good cause extensions when the issue is a jurisdictional matter. It's actually talking about 843.301, as I pointed out. Is it your position that 843.215.1, the 7-day time period, is a jurisdictional matter? That is, the ALJ doesn't have jurisdiction to, like, in effect, reconsider his own order and convert it to a full order absent the 7-day period? I mean, it's a little different than taking an appeal to the ICO. It's within the chambers of the ALJ.
Correct. And I believe what in this particular case, how that all intertwines, is ALJ Hart made his order. He specifically requested the 7 days. You must within 7 days request a summary order.
Notify
petitioner
her.
Did not.
Right.
She went back to the judge to reconsider it. He denied that under jurisdictional grounds. And I believe what Sperry does is say if it's a jurisdictional issue, that is not discretionary.
There any case law says the decision that he made that it was a jurisdictional issue is a supportable decision. That for 843.215.1, the 7-day period, is a jurisdictional matter. I think that's what Judge Daly was actually asking before when I interrupted. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, well,
I don't know if there's, is there any case that says that that decision, that 7-day period is a jurisdictional period?
Doesn't Walmart say that? It was 15 at the time, but doesn't Walmart say that statute is a jurisdictional statute?
And that's just what I was going to respond to. Now, it before is a 15-day. And in fact, Walmart discussed 15 days, as did many of the cases. The 7-day period was changed later in the statute, but it's the same concept. You must request this full finding or finding fact before you can appeal. So that's how that ties.
You have to put the two cases together to get where you want us to go, Walmart and Spire.
Yes, and in fact, Spire cited Walmart in its discussion.
Counsel, can I ask you about the argument that 7 days is in and of itself just too short and may deprive a party of due process?
Just to that part of it, I obviously would hate to ever think of what thinking is up under the gold dome on the hill, but I do have to say, certainly I think that is a very short period almost for anything. The only maybe saving grace is it's 7 business days, not calendar. But I do believe it is awful short, but I believe we have to comply.
I recall reading a case that says not only do you have to, the ALJ must actually know of your request within that time. In other words, it has to be almost physically delivered to him or her.
Yes, there is actually, remember the case right now, it might be, it's not Broder, but there is a case that actually says if you send it to the wrong office of the ALJ, then you've lost your right to appeal because it has to be at that ALJ, at that office. If the court needs a case, I certainly can find it in just a few minutes. Okay. Thank you.
We have almost 5 minutes.
Thanks, Judge. The Spire case actually has to do with petitions to review. It doesn't have to do with requesting full findings. So he misspoke on that when he said it applied to the statute we're talking about today, and this is a 2008 decision. So it's an opposite.
Walmart's not an opposite, is it?
Walmart is not, but Walmart was under a different statute. That under that statute, there was 15 days. I'm saying 7 days is too short. Under the 15 days, once you've made your request for full findings, it suspends a period for appeal. It told the period in which to file a petition to review, and the current statute does not. There was another statute that was adopted in between these two statutes, which was no summary orders. It was all, you know, you had to do a final order, and you had 30 days to do it. So they haven't been readopted. It's been changed each time. So I think the 7-day issue has to do with these evidentiary hearings. You know, here's the evidentiary hearing, let's move it along. I don't think it applies on remand. That's my argument.
And it's also normally the case in terms of excusable neglect, at least under most of the civil rules, if not all, that you have to file that request for an extension within the time frame of the statute or rule, and here you filed it 1 day late. I mean, no, you can ask for an extension because you know you're going to be unable to get it done for some reason. But if you've in fact not got it done, you're done.
I think if you look at the history of the appeals in this case, you'll see that I hit every deadline except this one.
Do you have any? Just let me ask a question because it's come up in discussion. Do you have somebody in your office that opens your mail and can alert you to these things if they come in while you're away at trial?
Yes, sir, and there was obviously a breakdown on that. So I've instituted a plan for how to deal with that so it doesn't happen again. But here's what I want to talk to you about. If you find that you have jurisdiction and you can review these orders, I think it does bridge all the way back to the original order in 2005. And I think I did in my opening brief, The relief we're requesting is that, well, one, I don't think you have to send it back to the ALJ. I think you can send it to the director. On remand, you can send it to ICAP, ALJ, or the director. This ALJ has admitted he can't calculate the benefits. One thing that's not included in the record are all the pleadings that were filed the year before this appeal. And I asked to supplement the record, and that was denied. We have no way of knowing what gets sent to ICAP when they're reviewing one of these issues. We don't get a copy of the record. They don't send it to us. Mr. Stirk and I both agree that probably a year's worth of pleadings were not included in the record here. And one of the things that's in there is I had asked a case manager of the division to help with these calculations, sent him all the documentation. He calculated it, sent me a letter. He copied everyone, including the judge. Opposing counsel was then another lawyer at Mr. Stirk's firm, filed a motion to strike saying the judge shouldn't look at that. This judge has problems. He's having problems going through and reconciling each benefit period. I think he can send it back to the division. So we want compliance with the 2005 opinion that says she gets the increase in average weekly wage. We want a finding that respondents waived the right to use Medicare as a substitute for that calculation because it was ripe in 2004 and they didn't raise it. There is an issue of permanent partial.
Is that issue raised before the ALJ?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I raised that every which way I can since 2004. There's an issue about miscalculation of the lump sum, what was paid, and what credit they get. I think they did pay the full lump sum, and they're taking a double credit for it. There is permanent partial disability that was awarded in 1999. They want credit on that as benefits they owed 5 years later. There's a case on point, National Fruit versus Crispin. We want that case to apply. That's part of the problem with the summary order. The judge said they get credit, but then he doesn't say credit on what? Those things all make a difference in terms of how you calculate benefits. So we're asking for a specific direction from this court and an order telling them when to do it, because look what happened here. 11 months after remand is when we got a summary order that doesn't even address the issues you sent back to be reviewed. So I'm about 9 seconds left, and God bless you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for their time. It's a very unusual and somewhat difficult case. It will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.